Coming from the lower eight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. All right, yabba dabba doo, or hip hip hooray, I guess is the theme today.
Hip is the theme.
Indeed, we are going to be talking to John Leland, author of Hip, The History. And you'll have to forgive me, this is self-indulgence week. we may be comparing books a little bit.
I was thinking about that.
Yeah, because we actually tried to get our book companies to get together and sort of do a dual publicity thing with them. But
nice.
They couldn't hook it in with a current event. We couldn't come up with a something newsy enough for them to hook it in. So it's very hard to get big book companies to do anything.
You'll
these
need to
days.
Learn to write your book to fit the upcoming events they can market to.
I am going to write every book I ever write from now on specifically to please Oprah Winfrey and for no other reason, actually.
Then she'll give you away on her show.
Absolutely. They can with each car.
That's right.
An RU clone with every
RU
single
in every SUV.
Car. So anyway, I also have to tell you all once again about an online class that I'm teaching for the Maybe Logic Institute on questioning and challenging authority. And this course is an outgrowth of an earlier course that I did around my book, which I'm going to mention as many times as possible today. And you will get tired of this, but I'll probably a few more weeks and I will stop having product to sell.
It'll be like a drinking game. Every time he mentions this book, you take a shot.
That's a good idea. Or shoot up. No. Did I? I did not say that.
No.
Never.
We're
never
find
shoot
out
up.
If drugs are hip later.
Okay. We will, actually. And so that class decided, that counterculture class decided that besides batting around ideas, we should try to do something. And we came up with this idea for a question authority coalition. Basically, we thought we would do two things. We would create a web-based location for information about all the different varieties and flavors of anti-authoritarian philosophy and history and activism, everything from your libertarians to your anarcho-capitalists to your left-wing anarchists to your civil libertarians and to, you know, whatever kind of other lunatics are amongst us. And we would create, you know, this space, clearinghouse kind of thing. And then we would create a context for pushing non-authoritarian spokespeople onto the national stage so that, you know, when loony talk show hosts, thus and such, is having a discussion, instead of it being left against right, sometimes maybe it should
be middle and far
it
left.
Should be the authoritarian position versus the non-authoritarian or less authoritarian
position.
Well,
that's an interesting thought, too. What about, like, an index of the most currently powerful authoritarian...
We're going to do some of that, too. We're going to take a look at...
Good
also,
idea.
In within the mainstream, we're going to give different people in Congress an index on, you know, their authoritarian tendencies, which generally, on the whole, is almost 100% across both parties. But there's enough variation there to make that worth doing. So anyway, these were all ideas, and as usual, nobody actually did anything. So I created a course, and maybe within the context of the course, we will actually do something. And if
well,
not,
you actually did something, though.
And I did. I created a course. And so maybe we'll do something, and if not, we will have an interesting exchange of ideas.
How does it work, by the way, this course? Is it email correspondence or is it
people log on. There's like it's like a bulletin board, basically. People
okay.
log online. I establish a bunch of different topics, and eventually class members also establish their own topics, and people just go in and talk. And then they set up, like once every few weeks, they set up this telephone situation where everybody can sort of gather together over the phone and talk with the great master himself. usually like in between, you know, watching CSI and, you know, Arrested Development or something. But I nevertheless become suddenly a font
so
of...
So you prepare, obviously.
A font of creating. I become a...
Will there be a class reunion?
A very own
anyway,
benevolent authority.
Exactly. So we've got our gang of three here today, and we have Jeff Deal and Diana.
Hello.
And since I'm going to introduce the topic,
okay,
you welcome me.
I will. Well, we are very excited here today, the gang of three. Of course, Jeff Deal, myself, Diana Brown, and we are thrilled to have with us today our usual host, Are You Serious? Welcome.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
Natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world.
So right now, here in San Francisco, Peter Coyote, Jonah Raskin, David Meltzer, a bunch of other people are over in a library celebrating the 50th anniversary of the famous poetry reading at San Francisco's Gallery 6. Mm-hmm. And there in 1955, Allen Ginsberg read Howl. He saw the best minds of his generation gathered together there, and he read Howl, and the beats blew up big all over the country on the basis of that. And
there are celebrations all over the world for this.
It's crazy. And Gary Snyder was there. Michael McClure was there and performed that night. They also became legendary poets. And... God, there's another thing, a bigger, more commercial thing happening at the Herbst Theater this Friday night, actually. And I would have liked to have gone to this one today, but unfortunately I got to do my show for you people out
Judy
there,
calls.
You naggy people out there. But no, I'm happy to be here, and I may attend the other bang.
When you get a second, could you tell us about your book?
You know, thanks for it. No, I refuse it. The beats are discussed in this fabulous book. Anyway.
There you go. There is an actual connection.
So my question here for my co-hosts, some of whom are younger than I am, actually. So does the beat go on? Yeah, the beat goes on, and drums keep pounding rhythm to the brain.
Yada,
a lot of
da-da-dee,
a lot of da-da-day.
Exactly.
Does all this mean much to you? Do you look back on... Ginsberg and Kerouac?
I
and
do.
Cream
I mean,
in your jeans?
They're I don't want to go that far.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe metaphorically. They are kind of legends looming over, you know. They also did seem to have something of a self-destructive quality. But
not so much Ginsberg.
Not so much Kerouac. Ginsberg, exactly. Kerouac, for sure.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, the whole beat generation always reminds me of my brother. He lived here before I moved here, and so he took me to North Beach and showed me around and took me to Vesuvio's, took me to City Lights. So
yeah.
It's a special place for me, that. But I think that...
So was your brother cool, or was he annoying?
He's definitely cool. He's very cool. Yeah. And I looked up to him. He was the older hipster. It was his generation, so I was the also-ran.
So was he down and out? Did he smoke a lot of cigarettes? Did he drink a lot of booze?
He smoked cigarettes. He drank red wine. I can't say that he was so much down and out, but I think everyone of his generation, you know, wanted to be very cool and look to those people as the leaders.
Because a beat meant beat, actually. Beat meant kind of up against the wall and down and out, and
this,
you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally. I remember Tim Leary called it a loser cult back when he was on his high horse in the late 70s. There's always that the kind of aspect of it, you know. It's what's his name? Oh, Will Franken, kind of, when he made fun of the spoken word poet, you know, it's like, I'm so urban. And
that listen spoke to that a little bit,
perhaps
too.
There's something of that. Ginsberg, of course, Howl was one of the great poems.
Yes.
Maybe some of his other poems afterwards were not quite as powerful as Howl.
No.
So, I mean, the legacy in terms of writing is mixed, perhaps. Michael McClure is a wonderful poet, actually.
Absolutely.
Well, it's interesting that meaning of beat that you just described, of being down and out, up against the wall.
Right.
I seem to recall there were a lot of the beats who were like, deliberately kind of cast themselves into this sort of street life.
Absolutely.
And it makes me think of Hate Street today. Not that they really resemble the beats, but there are all of these kind of like affluent teenage kids who thrust themselves into homelessness and drug abuse and raise these pit bulls on the street and sell weed
and
almost as a rejection of their parents' affluence. But still, I don't know how much that's actually going on these days outside of Hate Street. You know, that sort of like lifestyle choice of being down and out, pretty much being on the street and living and begging for money.
Why do affluent romanticize poverty?
I think it's about maybe as popular as it was in the 50s, whereas like in the 60s it was totally popular to go drop out and live on the street. And I did it for a large portion of the early 70s. Actually, I missed the good part of it, but I figured, what the heck,
I'm going to get what I can.
I still don't know what I want to do, so I might as well, I could be really good at doing nothing. I excelled at it.
And now you teach a course.
But there was this period where being a street person was like,
it was noble.
Lots of people were doing it, and now there's kind of it's self-selecting. Now the beats, the big beats. William Burroughs was a remittance man. He had enough money to live on because his family had the Burroughs machine stuff, and so he got his money. And Ginsberg came from a middle class family, and so did Kerouac. Mm-hmm. Who was the other fellow? The fourth wheel. Corso was a real working class guy, and a lot of people around them that they connected with were actually more working class or came from poverty. But the beats, I think, did lead into the hippies, and did create the sexual revolution, and I think the anti-war movement stopped Richard Nixon from nuking Hanoi. So I think that you can make a claim. You can draw a line and say that the beats saved the world.
Nice.
If you want to really, go overboard.
Which we do want to do.
And speaking of going overboard, I'm looking forward to talking to John Leland. John Leland was editor-in-chief of Details, a music writer for Spin, and he currently writes for the New York Times. But we're here today primarily to talk to him about his recent book, now in paperback, Hip, The History. So just trust me and go out there and read this book. Welcome, John.
Thanks. How are you? How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Today, actually, they're having a reading in honor of Allen Ginsberg's Howl at the public library. So
it's the 50th anniversary.
50th anniversary. Yeah. So instead of being there, I'm here talking to you, and you're in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Have you seen John Sinclair around?
I have not seen him, but if I see him, I will be sure to pass on regards.
Oh yes,
that's very nice.
Say hello. Anyway, I've been thinking about the difference between counterculture, as a word, as a signifier, and hip, as a signifier, and as related ideas. And I was thinking that counterculture is sort of like Allen Ginsberg standing naked and speaking straight from the heart, and it's Tim Leary and Abbie Hoffman sort of saying flat out, without any hesitation, exactly what they want and how they want to change things and the kind of upheaval they want in culture or politics. Whereas hip is more like Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan, William Burroughs, Miles Davis is sort of sly and cagey and ambiguous and sneaky, and it winks at you. So, in other words, hip is a lot hipper than counterculture, and I'm very jealous of this this book that you got to write. So, do you think that does that resonate with you?
I think that absolutely does. And another thing is that hip is a judgment imposed upon the people by others. Counterculture is something you would claim for yourself and aspire to.
That's true. I was thinking that. Somebody who would self-identify as hip, first of all, they might not even want to say that. And secondly, I mean, you run into somebody who self-identifies with hip as hip, and they're probably going to offer you like a cigarette and a swig of Jack Daniels and, you know, maybe some smack or something like that. Whereas you bump into somebody who identifies as counterculture, and they're very liable to tell you what you should be eating, you know, and how to be righteous and so forth. And you have a quote in one of your interviews. You say, my tastes do run towards impurity and contradiction. And there's a trickster attitude underlying all that. Go and talk a little bit about how you go into the trickster spirit as a hip phenomenon in the book.
Well, the trickster is, I think, one of the manifestations of hip, and I devote a chapter to him. And some of the characters I play out in that are P.T. Barnum and Mark Twain and Dylan and Muhammad Ali, up to Richard Hell, and I think we could take it a little further than that. I think there are people that a healthy society invents to break that society's own rules. And unlike countercultural figures, I think in the pure sense, they are sole operators, individual agents, provocateurs, and they are constantly changing and reinventing themselves, and they make you question what the value of the true is.
Right, so it's a playful quality. I mean, there's a lot of crossover between the people that I talk about. I mean, to some extent, Leary and Hoffman, for instance, were tricksters, but then Dylan probably is more of a trickster than either one of them. And all this has roots in African American culture, and in fact, as you emphasize in the book, there really wouldn't be any hip in the Western sense without African American culture and without a peculiar intersection between slaves and Jews, basically, right?
Well, you know, I trace the word hip. The nearest we can tell is it goes back to West Africa, to this word hippie or heppy, meaning to see or to open your eyes. And so it comes to us with the West African slaves and circulates through the mainstream American culture, through that interaction between this European population and African population who had to invent identities for themselves as Americans on this new soil in each other's presence and under each other's influence.
And that has something to do also with what we were talking about, the trickster quality, because it's hip is a secret language, largely.
Yeah, it is. And it's underground. It should be underground and percolate up from sort of the low rungs of society to the top. And it should be a way to invent a hierarchy for people who are at the bottom of one social ladder to place themselves at the top of another one.
Right.
And to consider this other social ladder superior than to the one that would put them at the bottom.
Right. And you can't be richer than anybody, but you could always be hipper than anybody.
That's right.
It's a cheap entry into a social,
into the great leveler, I think you said.
Right, great distinction in social status.
Now, could you tell us the difference between hip and cool? You made a point of that in the book that I thought was interesting.
I do make a point of it in the book. You know, I think most of us use the terms interchangeably
exactly. In
daily life, so it's kind of pedantic to insist on it. But you know, I talked about the origins of hip, the word hip. Robert Farris Thompson at Yale has traced the origins of cool also back to Africa. And cool is kind of the behavior that is the front for hip. You know, it's that Miles Davis stoicness of not letting you in on what's going on behind his sunglasses or behind those, you know, penetrating eyes of his.
Right.
So then hip is the thinking. Thompson says cool is the mask of mind itself. And I think if that's the case, then hip is that mind behind the mask.
Now can somebody like Miles Davis be hip without a culture there to confirm him as hip? I mean, obviously it becomes hip because there is a receiving audience, but does it matter to somebody like Miles Davis that is the case? I mean, is there a secret longing to be acknowledged as hip, do you think? Or the hippest people don't even care if they're acknowledged or not?
Well, I think we're all performers, and we all love to perform. I think that the hip people don't let on that they're performing. And and are willing to turn their back on their audience. I mean, Miles did it literally. But yes. Also, if you look at someone like Miles or Dylan, when the public caught up with them, they changed themselves to something that was often hostile to the public or antithetical to the people that loved them. Because I think playing to that audience is the same as being obedient to your boss. You know, it's a kind of subservient position. And those two people particularly understood that very well. And so they were never out there out to please. They never saw pleasing the public as the highest goal.
Yeah, Dylan made a very firm point about that in the Martin Scorsese biopic, actually. That was kind of interesting. Does somebody like that remain hip through all the peculiar changes, like becoming a Christian fundamentalist for a while, getting involved in authoritarian forms of Judaism for a while, becoming preachy, and then going back to being the mystery man some years later? How do people maintain hip?
Well, I don't know. You could tell me this. You could answer this certainly as well as I can. I seem to remember Dylan in those late 70s, maybe early 80s to early 90s period as being incredibly unhip. You know, the guy dressed really badly, had the bad hair.
Right.
Went out there, often lousy in his performances, and turned it around. And now we think, oh, yeah, the guy was always as hip as he was throughout. But
he had
that
Neil Diamond period.
Right? He so did. Yeah. Now, I could be paraphrasing you terribly, but I think at one point you said that you sort of feel that you're hip by the very virtue of never having been hip. Words to that effect.
Oh, no, you're doing me bad. I was never
hip. I apologize.
I've never been hip.
No.
Well, we're going to start calling you hip.
Are you hip?
Pardon?
What happened between you and Chuck D, anyway? I don't think we ever got the full story.
We had something of a contentious relationship, and that's something also that takes on a different color in retrospect. I did not like the group's first record and wrote about that in the Village Voice, and they said that they were coming to get me at a party at one point. And it was a time when you didn't take those kind of threats seriously. He was someone that loved to battle, but in words, that's what they did. And so he wrote this song, Bring the Noise, and said that part of it was about me.
Well, that's kind of hip, actually. To
you
be,
are hip, see?
Well, I've been able to dine out on that for a while.
Yeah. To dine out on that, that's a lovely phrase.
Let's stop for a moment and listen to some hip music, or perhaps some unhip music, just because it's hip to not be hip right now, and then we'll be right back talking more with John Leland.
Mono Mix 4.
Take 3. You're cruising along, eating up reefers.
Keep things moving, keep things rolling along. Man, we're talking
reefers.
Man, he's talking
reefers.
Keep things moving, keep things rolling along. Man, we're talking.
Yeah, man, I'm talking reefers. Sweet and easy. Less sway on your pullouts to pass slower moving traffic.
Man,
yeah.
Man, man,
yeah. It's easy to pass slower moving traffic.
Man,
no sweat on those reefers.
Man, man, he's talking.
Keep in mind, I'm talking
easy tracking.
Reefers,
easy handling.
Reefers,
keep things moving, keep things rolling along.
Yeah. Safe, smooth, no sweat.
Keep things moving, keep things rolling along. Man,
yeah.
Man, he's rolling along.
Reefers, yeah.
Keep rolling along.
Sweet reefers.
Man.
Yes, that's a mighty good name to keep in mind.
Man, we're talking.
Reefers.
Man, he's talking.
Yeah, yeah. Reefers for the real rugged going. With a minimum of downtime. Stop. Stop. You're in time.
Keep things moving. Keep things rolling along.
yam, yam. You're in time.
Keep things moving.
You're in stop. Quick.
And we're talking.
Yam reefers for easy tracking. Quick handling. Safe, smooth stops. I'm talking sweep. You're in stop. Quick.
Keep things moving.
Quick.
Man, we're talking.
You're in.
Man.
You're in. I'm talking along, safe, smooth, reefers, urine, stop, quick, quick.
Man, we're talking.
Reefers.
Man, and he's talking.
Reefer, urine, quick.
Keep things rolling.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, reefers. So if you're in the business of hauling reefers and eating reefers, take it all. It's easy.
Keep things moving.
Why settle for less? There's a nationwide network of dealers to serve you. Stop. Quick. Stop. Quick. Quick. Urine time.
Take three.
Stop. Safe urine stop. Urine stop. Stop.
Take seven.
Sweet reefer.
Urine stop. 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 Quick. Quick. Stop. 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 Quick.
Given HIP's roots in African American experience, there are some peculiar strains of HIP that are very white that have come along through the years. As I like the early punk with the Ramones and Legs McNeil's punk magazine, they were all like pretty much like militantly white. And then geek culture, which is sort of this disembodied form of HIP. It gets to be HIP through dance culture somewhat, but how does I mean, I should probably be explaining this, but I'm throwing it on you. How does geek culture get to be HIP?
Well, so much of what I learned about geek culture was from reading you. You're in Mondo 2000, so you're to blame for some of this. But and I also don't think geek culture was white per se. I think it was very white and Asian.
Right.
At least my experience of it. But I think geeks did what any sort of hip culture did. They had their own language. They invented their own social hierarchy. And they had access to this knowledge that, and these worlds of knowledge that the rest of the public couldn't go into. And they could reinvent themselves as characters within that world, certainly, and also outside of it.
At what point, you're probably, maybe editing at the details at, say, during the early 90s when the whole geek thing happened? Was that where you were, or were you at Spin?
Well, bear in mind, I was only the editor of details for a minute. But that minute did take place during some of the geek era, yes.
Well, Roger Trilling was running around to a lot of geek fests at that time. I know he was an associate. At what point did it seem to people in the world of New York City that the geek thing was hip? And did you associate that with the San Francisco Bay Area? Or did you find it going on there in New York?
Well, it did go on in New York, but I think we definitely had a sense of ourselves as being behind the curve on this one, that San Francisco was out there. And you saw it coming from San Francisco, and it was involved with, you know, at least as it crossed the country, it was wrapped up in some ways with the other subcultures of San Francisco, the modern primitives culture, the industrial scene, I think.
Sure, yeah.
And the electronica, which was, I always felt was bigger and better on the West Coast than it was on the East Coast.
So as a music person, I mean, when electronica hit, I mean, I was sort of in the middle of tech culture, so I was sort of in a position where I had to like it, and I didn't really like it that much at first. You know, I was like, you know, I'd really rather be listening to Elvis Costello. But how did it strike you?
Oh, I think, you know, some of it I loved, some of it I didn't. You know, I was getting a little older at this point and was not in clubs as much as I had been or some of the other things. You know, I experienced Elvis Costello in clubs. I experienced some of the electronica in this sort of secondhand way of listening to it at home.
Right.
Still on records, you know, those 12-inch black things that we remember so well.
What?
But, you know, not being out and living it every night and taking the correct substances to fly with it, right.
Speaking of substances, I guess, I mean, if I want to go back to the counterculture versus hip idea, I guess, I mean, counterculture would probably be pot and psychedelics, and hip would be like pot and heroin and speed and drinking and so forth. Would that be a general association that you would make?
I think so. You know, I had so much fun with your book because it covered a lot of the same areas and a lot of the same ideas, but really from a different perspective, and right. I thought you brought so much wisdom to that, and I kept thinking, boy, he hit this, and I wish I had thought of that. You know, I wish I'd come to it with that angle. And you got into this whole question of enlightenment and I think the supernatural, maybe, in ways that I wish I had been able to get at.
Well, let me return the compliment, because you got to write sort of in a more expository style, whereas I set up these kinds of, here are the three, facets of counterculture and followed along those lines. But I enjoyed the fact that there was so much intersection within the book. I'm wondering, you probably have a different experience than I do going out representing your book. That when I go out representing my book, people want me to deliver the revolution, explain why the counterculture hasn't delivered a perfectly marvelous, wonderful world and hasn't delivered, enlightenment, revolution, whatever. Whereas with hip, you're sort of not promising that in the first place. But do you get some of that? Do you get when you go out talking to people about the book, do they come at you sort of from the perspective of, hip doesn't succeed in changing the world, it's too easily co-opted and that sort of thing?
Well, I thought they would come at me with the idea of just coming out to prove how much hipper than me they were.
Yeah.
And there's been a little bit of that, and it's not the toughest sell in the world, but there's been a little bit less of that than I thought. But there is a sense what people want explained is why it feels so commercialized and pre-processed and packaged.
Right. And how do you deal with that?
Well, one of the things I say is that people have been making that complaint since the late 20s, early 30s. You know, Floyd Dell, who had been one of the bohemians in Greenwich Village before the First World War, made this complaint then. He said, it's all over now. America had come to the end of its Puritan phase and was looking to bohemians to tell it how to spend its war profits. Right. In other words, that, hip was this kind of selling idea from the start. And I think that it only makes sense. What does hip want? Hip wants, a constant turnover of styles, new ideas, outrageous things. And what does the market want? The market wants, those exact same things.
So, and this, of course, is the Robert Frank analysis Thomas Frank analysis, The Conquest of Cool. Is this something to complain about, or is this simply something to accept, that the sort of DNA of hip, part of the DNA of hip was commerce?
Well, I think it's always been there. I think Thomas Frank is terrific, and I thought that book, Conquest of Cool, was very good, and What's the Matter with Kansas, even better. But I'm not quite as cynical as he is. I think that there's still that dimension of it that runs alongside commerce. And look, we live in a commercial world, and so hip has this commercial element to it as well.
I think
it's asking too much of it to think that it's really out there to bring down capitalism.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, though, doesn't like the hip of irony allow for sort of the pursuit or the study of anything, including commerce and the mainstream? If you study anything or embrace anything on an idiosyncratic level, you can do it and be hip. It doesn't really matter what the content of it. You can be ironic, for instance.
Yeah, as long as we don't have this idea that we are engaging in the revolution when we listen to the Velvet Underground.
Darn.
Okay.
How hard we tried. I want to talk, before I let you go, I want to talk for a few moments about rock journalism. You were engaged in rock journalism for a while. And why has rock journalism since the 70s been so subdued? You know, why doesn't another Lester Bangs ever seem to rise to the surface? Or, I mean, could Greil Marcus even start today as a rock journalist? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Because as a commercial entity, rock journalism doesn't want that. It, you know, if you are the fly in the ointment, a complainer, you don't get the work. You know, if you're writing about records for XXX record magazine,
right?
And you say that this record isn't good, well, then that's going to be the seventh review in the section, and it's going to be small. And if you say that such and such really represents a maturation process for Britney Spears and with saw her before, then you can have the lead review, and they'll, you know, you'll get the next assignment, you'll get the bigger check. So there's all these incentives for the journalist not to be these truth tellers.
So the editors, basically the publishers and the editors, are just not letting them through the process, which is a shame. Cream was such a great magazine in the 1970s. But it seems like, I mean, somebody should be able to, like, convince Winner or Guccione or one of those guys that they need a few gonzo rock writers. But I guess, I mean, would there be an audience for it? So how hip are people in their, like, late teens and 20s now? Are they hip, or are they, like, you know, Frankie Avalon, Britney Spears kind of mentality?
Well, I have a kid who's that age, and when I went to visit him at camp, he was doing his DJ show, and we arrived, he was listening to Jimmy Smith, and I had to say I was pretty proud of that.
That is
I'm
cool.
I'm proud as well.
Wow. Well, I think we have to leave it on that note, man. Thanks for talking to us.
Hey, are you? Thanks a lot.
Okay, take care.
Serious.
We would like to thank John Leland for joining us on the show today. Our gang of three, once again, was Are You Serious?, Diana Brown, and me, Jeff Deal. Next week, distinguished philosopher Richard Rorty returns. The Are You Serious? Show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Subscribe to all of our shows at mondoglobo.net. This has been the Are You Serious Show. Thanks for listening, and don't be afraid of the dark.